Hello, everyone. Welcome to Private Schooling and COVID-19. How has the sector fared? My name is Neil McCluskey, and I am the director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute. I welcome you all. I think the moment that COVID-19 and especially COVID-19 lockdowns occurred, if you cared about private schooling or school choice, or just maybe your child is in a private school, maybe your first thought, it was, what is going to happen to private schools? Are private schools really in a lot of trouble with COVID-19, and not just for the health reasons, but for financial reasons? Certainly, this is what came into my head, is that maybe all schools were going to be in trouble because we thought there was going to be a major and maybe long-lasting economic downturn. And private schools, unlike public schools, don't have a guaranteed flow of funding. They have to get it from people paying tuition and often other voluntary funds. Sometimes it would come from a church or a parish who would also be locked down. And so you didn't have congregations coming together, maybe taking up collections for the schools. In-person fundraising like auctions were canceled. And you may have thought, well, this does not bode well at all for private schools. And like me, you might have feared that we'd lose hundreds or thousands of these schools as a result of COVID-19 and the lockdowns. But then as time went on, you might have started to feel a little better because you would have seen stories like I saw that, well, actually, especially as we started the 2020-21 school year, that private schools were opening in person as many public schools were remaining online only. And we saw articles that said, well, actually, private schools are attracting lots of new students. And you thought, well, okay, maybe this bodes well for private schooling and maybe this sector will actually come out ahead. But then you might read those stories more deeply, as I did, and continue to follow the data as it trickled out about how private schools were doing. You thought, oh, well, actually, but those new students may be anecdotal, and they may not be making up for the loss of students at private schools suffered as a result of COVID-19. And so maybe they still may be in trouble. And so you may have sort of been riding an emotional roller coaster to figure out what is happening in private schooling. And that's certainly where I was. We'd like to know how private schools are doing. I'm going to talk a little bit about data that we at the Center for Educational Freedom, the Cato Institute, collected on private schools, in particular those that did end up closing with a specific connection to COVID-19. They said COVID-19 had an effect on their decision to close. I'll talk about that. But there still was a lot of data was hard to get. Most of what we collected was based on media stories about schools going out of business. We did some polling to try and get a sense of how enrollment was looking, but we saw different polls from different groups. So here to help us to get a much better handle on how private schools are doing, have done with COVID and maybe what the future looks like, are three people from private school associations who really know a whole lot about what happened in private schooling, in particular for the schools they work with. I'm just going to quickly give their names and their affiliations. You can find their bios online, but we want to get right to the substance as quickly as we can. So we have Donna Oram with us, who is the president of the National Association of Independent Schools. I think if your screen's like mine, she's on the upper right. Then we have Dale McDonald, who, if your screen is like mine, is on your lower right. She's the director of public policy at the National Catholic Educational Association. And then I think right beneath me on everybody's screen should be Lynn Swainer, who's the Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer for the Association of Christian Schools International. So the way we're going to work today is I'm going to give a quick overview of what we found with our private school closure tracker. We did a paper, which released a few weeks ago, on looking at closures and the schools, aspects of the schools within 1 year. And then I'm going to hand it off to all of our panelists to talk a little bit about what they've seen in their sector. And then, maybe 5 minutes or so, and then we're going to kick it off to questions and comments. Maybe a few from me, hopefully, though, mainly from you all who are watching, because you probably have lots of questions and maybe some that I didn't think of. Just as a reminder, if you are watching us on Twitter or if you're watching us on another platform, you have Twitter, or if you're on Facebook, you can send your questions or comments using hashtag CatoCEF. That's CatoCEF. You may be on YouTube or something else. There's should be a form there where you can fill out questions that you have. They'll eventually all make it to me so that I can pick lots of things that you are on your mind to ask the panelists, and maybe I'll answer a little bit of it myself. So now I'm just going to give a quick slide presentation, and I often try to avoid slides in our events because, as you all probably know, it's easy to have technical errors and problems, and I always try to make things look like they run as smoothly as possible. But I'm going to take a little chance. I'm going to try a slide, kind of just a few slides here, to give you just the basic information on what we have on school closures now, a little bit on the timing we saw of school closures, and then not a whole lot else before we move on. So here we go. Everybody hold on, because I'm about to try and share my PowerPoint presentation. I think with a little luck, it should show up right about now, and I will even put it on. There we go. Okay, so nobody needs the title page, really. So here is, this is taken, says where we are. It's taken from the Cato's Permanent Private School COVID-19 Closure Tracker. Since we saw the first private school announce that it was going to close, in part because of, at least in part because COVID-19 made the financial situation look impossible to deal with. Since the first one, we started, that was March 18th, 2020. This tracker actually goes through right now. We do have a paper, as I mentioned, that is up on our website. It is Private Schooling After a Year of COVID-19, How the Private Sector Has Fared and How to Keep It Healthy. That gives just a one-year snapshot. So you can see what happens from March 18, 2020 to March 17, 2021. But if you look at this slide, so we continue to update this tracker, and you can see we've had 140 closures. That we know of. So the important thing to understand is this tracker is only of things we found in media reports, which means there may be schools that have closed that either the media didn't report on or that the media reported on and we didn't find. So this is sort of a baseline level. But what we found of these schools were they were heavily Roman Catholic schools, also though of some different types. Total enrollment was about 22,000. And the tuition was actually quite low, about $7,030, which I'm going to talk about a little more in a moment. You may see net closures there. Some schools consolidated. So, you know, they might have gone away. You would have had two schools and now you have one. So we counted closures as both schools. But then after consolidation, you have fewer closures. And then also of interest are the closing school demographics. As you'll see in our paper, if you read our paper, the private schools that close look very similar to public schools in their demographics. So about half white, about 15% African-American, 23% Hispanic, around 5% Asian, looks a lot like public schools. And so this is the basics of where we are now. What we also found was there was a heavy concentration of closures in the Northeast. There's more to it. You can certainly read the paper and find out. I thought it would be interesting, though, just to give a sense of these private schools that have closed and where the spending is relative to what we spend on education. And again, this shows that we're talking about very low-cost, affordable schools that went out of business. You can see the COVID-19 closures, those schools that identified COVID-19 and its impacts as part of the reason they decided they had to close. The tuition was $7,066. This is now just in the first year of closure, so there have been some since. Private schools' average tuition overall is about $11,173. And it's important to put this in the context of what we spend on public schools, which is about $15,000 per student. So we're not talking about, you know, super expensive elite schools. We're talking about schools that are very affordable that have typically been the ones that have gone out of business. I should also say we have tried to track enrollment costs. This is one of the things we can talk about more because the best we've got is sort of an estimate. I estimate based on some of our own very limited survey work and other groups, maybe an enrollment loss of 5%. Across private schooling. That is a big estimate. And one thing that I think we'll talk about is Why wasn't this a bigger closure, big as maybe I feared it would be? There are a number of reasons, but the first may be, and we can talk more about this, is the PPP program, which was the Paycheck Protection Program that the federal government started with the CARES Act early in COVID-19 and then continued on. It appears that private schools were able to get, and churches they may be affiliated with, may have been able to get a lot of money to help them through the really tough times when the lockdowns had powerful economic effects. And also did the closure of public schools, especially as we entered the 2020-21 school year, that so many public schools remained online only and private schools in person, how much of an impact did that have? I also just want to show you quickly the timeline. So we have what happened under COVID. We had what happened under the lockdowns for COVID. Then my concern was, well, what happens going forward? Because we may still be following the effects. What you could see from our closures by month is that certainly in the beginning of COVID, there were a lot of closures. April, May, June, and July was where we saw the biggest numbers. What I wasn't sure was, well, is that typical? Because that would also be when schools are making decisions. Or was it exacerbated, at least by COVID? As we kind of re-enter those months again now in the new year, I expected to see a bigger uptick in closure announcements than we have tracked so far, 6 in April. And so it may be that we saw this big COVID effect and we will not see something similar going into the next month. And now with that, I am going to try and stop sharing. Let's see if I successfully can stop sharing. All right. And now I need to, Okay. Oh, there we go. All right. You may be seeing, can everybody see me again? I hope. Okay. So that is all. Those are all the slides I wanted to show. I think I managed to avert any major disasters. And so with that, I will hand it over, I think, to Donna. Would you like to go next to talk about how your school is?
Sure. And I will attempt to share as well to tell our story. So if you bear with me. Okay. Well, thanks for those opening slides. You know, I will start out with, it's been a very challenging year, but actually very few of our schools closed. We are a little more worried about the future, but I'm going to try to tell the story very quickly about the year. So I think the first thing to understand is COVID was really tough for schools, but there were a lot of headwinds before that. And these are just some of the bigger ones that were affecting our schools. You know, I'll certainly want to emphasize things like changing demographics. We were seeing a birth rate decline before COVID, and like other economic disasters, COVID has actually further pushed that down. But polarization is really increased, I think, with isolation. Systemic racism is something that we've been dealing with for a while, as well as the changing workforce. I'm a little nervous about that moving forward. But, you know, for us, when we look at COVID, there are a lot of financial pressures, but the well-being of our community has been really disrupted. So, you know, we are very concerned as well about mental health issues moving forward. But, you know, to start in March, when all the schools started closing down, I would say what was front and center for all of our schools was how do you keep the community together and how do we support students in every way needed? So, you know, if you can see this slide, I think you can understand that front and center in supporting students was trying to get back to face-to-face school. And you can see the progression. I know this is a little hard to consume, but you know, generally by March or April, the majority of our schools were open face-to-face or had a hybrid component. So this was not easy to do, very expensive to do, very hard on the community to do, but I think schools stepped back and said, you know, we just have to make sure that students get what they need during this time because it's very hard on them. You know, and that support in the beginning started with most of our schools went online overnight, and most were not really prepared for that. But they also knew that being online was really going to affect some students very negatively. So they started to make investments from, you know, advising relationships were increased, teacher check-ins. Schools put a lot of money into ensuring that they had counseling services and other kinds of mindfulness activities. And then they stepped back and said, what are these stress producers and can we bring these stress down? So that meant making changes to attendance and grading. Just that aspect of really focusing on students has been front and center since the beginning of the pandemic. But also, you know, when I talk about supporting the community, the other piece which was financially difficult was supporting families. Every family had a different situation. Some lost jobs, some lost businesses, some had to support other family members. So, you know, schools dived in right away, even though it was a tough time in the stock market early on, to try to aggressively fundraise. As you can see, a lot of schools developed these emergency grant funds that families could draw from. Many increased their financial aid budgets. But, you know, these two jobs stayed front and center. It's how do we keep our students safe and how do we keep our communities together? You know, and parents, by and large, gave thumbs up for this, you know, for the going online right away. And God knows everything was not perfect. I think what we were doing was more distance learning than online learning. And that's really improved over time. But, you know, parents felt that schools were really doing everything possible to serve their students and to make sure that their families were taken care of during this time. You know, at the same time, in pushing to open, faculty and staff were exhausted and scared. So, you know, I think the leaders in our school who have just been working tirelessly, you know, also spent a lot of time trying to keep the faculty community together. So, you know, they did everything from bonuses to spending an enormous amount of time on gratitude, you know, and giving them whatever kind of safety supports that they needed. But teacher attrition was still there during COVID, and this was tough. You know, some schools experienced teacher shortages. We had many early retirements. We saw people switching professions. So, you know, this is something else that was really tough to manage. You know, while we're trying to give all these additional supports, there was all this churn in the workforce as well. You know, and back to the opening slides, you know, it was tough financially. Bottom line is schools had to make huge investments and it was a tremendous hit on the bottom line. So for many schools, there was, you know, a loss of revenue. Many of them went into deficits. And, you know, are trying other ways to really get out of that. Many really aggressively put the pedal to the metal on fundraising to try to bring in those funds. And also PPP loans were taken by some schools, not all of them. And particularly for, I think, pre-K and elementary schools, this was really tough because they were really hit very hard early on. So the PPP loans were very helpful in keeping their faculty and staff together during this time. You know, but as I said, it's been a really tough year. And enrollments have been up and down. And, you know, we think next year is going to be a hard year. As you can see, it's a mixed bag. And enrollment, which we look at every 2 to 3 months, has just been up and down and up and down. But, you know, many of our schools who were struggling before the pandemic actually ended up doing better and having waiting lists because they did open. And it was certainly attracting many parents. So that is just a very top line view of what was going on at our schools during this time. So there's a lot more to really get into, but I think that tells the story of the year that we've had.
Great. You're starting to confirm what I thought, which is it's been kind of a roller coaster year. So, Dale, you're up.
Thank you. Our story has a lot of same parallels as we heard from the independent school world. But, you know, thanks to the incredible sacrifice and dedication of our Catholic school community, our teachers, our principals, our superintendents, Catholic schools seem to be managing this pandemic crisis with fairly good measure of success at great cost financially and as well as physical toll on people. Schools have been open for in-person learning in compliance with state and local health and safety measures. Not all schools were able to open under local mandates. But at the start of the school year, 92% of Catholic schools were open for full-time in-person instruction, along with hybrid for families that wanted that option, or if the school was not able to have enough space to comply with social distancing and so had to bring the kids in a couple of days a week, alternating days when students would attend. But at the start of the school year, we did have, you know, what made a lot of the papers, you know, 209 schools did actually close. Some of them escaped Neil's study, but directly reported to NCEA on our annual collection, 209 schools did close. And there was a 6.4% decline in enrollment. That was a little more than 111,000 students fewer than there were the school year before. And most of that was at the elementary school level, about 8.1%. But the biggest loss was with the preschool, as we've seen in public sector as well. But there was a 26.6% decrease in our pre-K enrollment, which is really quite a hit. But despite that kind of loss, the enrollment of the staffing percentages did not decrease that dramatically. In fact, it was only a 2.3% decrease in staffing, the professional staff, the teachers, principals, guidance counselors, et cetera. And a lot of that is attributable to the payroll protection program. Most of our schools did participate in that program and were able to keep staffing. The present issues that the schools are dealing with, first and foremost, would be the social-emotional issues that will likely be with us for the foreseeable future. As you know, students and teachers are trying to process their experience, their losses, their the realities that they've seen in families and in their communities, and that has an impact on school culture. Stressful in many instances as schools are trying to adapt to this new reality and provide emotional supports, looking to assist the whole school experience for students. So enrollment continues to be an issue as schools look toward the registration process for next year, and we're seeing in media reports school closures being announced. Schools do not report directly to NCEA. They report to their diocesan schools office. But we are hearing, you know, LA has already announced the closure of six schools. We're hearing consolidations in Pittsburgh and New York and different places around the country, anecdotally from newspaper accounts. So that will, you know, continue to be a concern. Will, you know, families have the financial resources to re-enroll? And a particular concern, of course, is what the pre-K enrollment will look like. As you know, the earlier grades, the pre-K, the K are the pipeline for enrollment in upper grades. So we're watching that closely. And then, you know, we've seen media reports of, you know, we're getting all these kids enrolling from public schools that aren't open. And while it's true that we did pick up a number, a little over 1,400, we've polled 1,400 families who did make the switch because they wanted full-time instruction. And many of them have said that they will continue. We did a survey and the majority of those said that they would return. But the loss of the students who were there, who can't afford to come back, is really troubling for us and for, and because most of those were in your inner city areas. Neil referred to that earlier. That demographic looks pretty much like a public school demographic. And a big part of our mission as church is to provide for the vulnerable. And we're looking at ways to do that when finances are an issue. And the available income from parish collections, from diocesan support, has been greatly diminished. And what was there has been, to a large extent, expended on trying to reopen. The finances, of course, continue to be an issue. Just maintaining the safe environment, the supplies that needed, the cleaning, the special attention to ventilation and all of that have required additional resources that while the federal programs have provided for them, the problems getting the financial resources sorted out at the state and district levels with which we have to, through which we have to participate, have really held up the actual flow of funding to take care of those services. The CARES Act and the subsequent additions of that and the American Recovery Program have provided for participation of private school students. We had expected equitable participation. We had expected the programs to be treated as a disaster recovery, the way we've seen in other programs going back to Katrina and all the other hurricane and wildfire assistance that was provided on an equitable basis. But through various political machinations, private schools are treated differently. That income status is now applied to participation of private school students and families, while it is not to public school. All public school students are benefiting for, and students are benefiting from these COVID relief packages. So that's a problem that we've had to overcome and have had delays in trying to get those services. Because of the nature of financial assistance to private schools, schools never get the direct funding. Schools work through their district or for the last two packages through their state to have to apply for services and to have the state or local district provide those services with the funding that was allocated. So that we're still trying to make up for some of the inabilities we had to provide, particularly the technology pieces for students whose families don't have the wherewithal to have the broadband connectivity and or multiple devices. You know, with two or three students at home on one computer, the learning curve has increased exponentially for students in our schools. And so while we've been able to provide some, we have not been able to provide adequately for all students with the technology. And then tuition finance, the finance aspect of tuition is still a key factor in whether or not families can return. And, you know, we have these cyclical issues with tuition. Students drop out, then tuition has to be raised to be able to continue to pay for what needs to be paid for and provide just wages. And then raising tuition causes, you know, more families to have to be able to drop out. So we're looking at the fact that for for Catholic elementary schools, the national average, 65% of funding for secondary schools comes from tuition. And 83% of the actual costs are paid for at elementary school level by tuition. And so compensating for the loss of the tuition has always been fundraising events. And those were significantly curtailed, if not eliminated during the pandemic. Most unfortunately, most schools do their big annual gala fundraisers in the spring. And that was when COVID hit last year. And many of them are still not able to do, because of social distancing restrictions, what they would be doing this spring as well. So to sum it up, I mean, the issues they're dealing with, you know, when we surveyed people was effective stakeholder communication, being in contact with families, giving them the information and getting the information that schools need to continue to be able to provide effective instruction. Then maintaining the physical and cleansing, maintaining the physical space, that still is a problem. The uncertain financial issues, you know, particularly for, as we mentioned earlier, those parishes and where mass attendance has not returned. And so the weekly collections have taken a big hit. Then procuring technology and connectivity for all students. And some of that is, you know, back orders and the raise in prices for things that have become scarce. Professional development of teachers to be able to adapt to this new reality and to teach effectively, hybrid models as well as complete virtual learning. But we've seen some positives that some schools have been able to find new revenue streams to make new partnerships possible within their community to be able to learn to adapt to new technologies and make that part of the effective learning environment and to overcome some of the initial reluctance of teachers. There was at the start some resistance on the part of very few, but a noticeable number that felt they just couldn't adapt to this. And you know, we've heard as in the independent schools, you know, some staffing issues. But going forward, I think, you know, we have put in a lot of temporary measures to adjust to enrollment and finance and marketing and professional development. And so hopefully, you know, this time of crisis has been an opportunity to learn new things and to innovate in ways that may provide a new chapter of, you know, vitality and vibrancy for Catholic schools and enable us to carry on our mission. So I'll leave it at that. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to tell a little bit about the Catholic school story.
Great. Lynn?
Well, hi, everyone. While I'm getting ready to share my screen, I want to apologize. Apparently, we're having a little bit of technical difficulty in the wilds of the western suburbs of Philadelphia. And therefore, my screen is glitching a little bit. So I apologize if you see that. Can everyone see my screen? Okay. So just a quick, first of all, a lot resonated with what my colleagues have already shared, so I won't belabor a lot of the same points, but a little bit about the Association of Christian Schools International. We serve 2,300 schools in the U.S. for a little bit over 500,000 students. We are a global organization, but that is our profile in the U.S. We did 3 major surveys of our U.S. membership and also of our international, but I'll report out on the U.S., obviously, in May, July, and December of 2020. So really quickly, the pivot to distance learning, when we surveyed schools in March 2020, 98% of schools reported that their campuses were physically closed. But we asked them how quickly they pivoted to distance learning, and very similar to what Donna shared, it was a very quick pivot. So I'll just draw your attention to the orange circle. You can see that a third of our schools on average miss no instructional days. About two-thirds miss less than 3 instructional days, and about 80% miss less than 5 instructional days. And this was really a Herculean effort on the part of our schools to move their instruction online as quickly as they could. And of course, we also have other data. They said that they did it with great fidelity. So they actually continued to offer both core, elective, and in some cases, art and physical education, if you can imagine. So a Herculean effort certainly did create a lot of stress for our schools, but because of their commitment to their mission and their desire to serve their communities, this was what we were able to see with our schools. Fast forwarding to as of December 2020, so this was just a few months ago, asking what the status was. We see a quarter of our schools were fully in person only. A little bit over half were in person with a distance option for folks, maybe students didn't feel comfortable, et cetera. About 7% required some form of blended learning. About 8% said other, but there was some kind of on-site learning for that. And about 4% were distance only. So we have 96% of our schools are doing in-person instruction. I don't have a slide for you here, but with a high degree of care, caution, fidelity to local and state health departments, and also all kinds of cleaning protocols, distancing, everything you can imagine has been put in place to do this safely. And the disruption data that we have in terms of COVID actually shows that there are not significant disruptions of instruction and risk and safety so far, as you've probably seen on the national media for private schools that open. We were, you know, a lot of people were predicting sort of Armageddon in terms of COVID infections, and that in fact was not the case. Looking quickly at enrollment impact, this is this academic year as opposed to last. We have about half of our schools showed a decline in enrollment, about a third an increase, and then about 15% steady. Most frequently, schools reported a range of decline between 5 to 10%. So certainly not positive, but also not extreme. And those who reported a gain, it most frequently was between 5 and 10%. Over a third of our schools reported enrollment growth since the start of school. So that was picking up students who has been shared by my colleagues whose families were dissatisfied with other options or their regular option for school and chose to enroll their students predominantly for that in-person instruction. CARES Act participation, the payroll protection loans were key for our schools. Over 80% participated, about 14% did not. I would like to echo what was said about the Catholic schools in terms of equitable services. This was very much a mixed story. We had close to half of our schools participating. We're very grateful for those local agencies and school districts that were good partners in getting this distributed, but it was a very, very mixed story in terms of our schools being able to access those funds for their students and a lot of intervention that we had to do in some cases as an association, even legally, to assist with that. Emergency financial aid, similar to what NAIS found, over two-thirds of our schools offered emergency financial aid for families in need. And this was, again, you know, people had lost their jobs, et cetera. So family businesses taking hits. So really that community care, which will come up in a bit. I do want to share some closure data. We found some similar things too. I think, Neil, what you found, but a little bit of gradation. I want to share before I put this on the screen, these are closures for any reason. We did not disaggregate this data based on whether it was COVID related or not. So this really could be for any reason, but like Donna had shared, I think that COVID accelerated for a lot of schools issues they were already having. So we had about 75 schools that closed. That's about 3% of our membership. 10 were in early education, and 65 had grades somewhere in K to 12. This is the distribution here. You'll notice that the lion's share, 80%, had an enrollment range of 0 to 99 students. And this is significant because these schools tend to charge lower tuition. They tend to be less financially solvent or more at risk. And what we see is that in 2020, 1 out of 10 schools in this size range closed. And again, the numbers are not huge, but these are huge for their communities. These are, again, smaller schools that are serving populations that are in need of private school and Christian education. So certainly not as the high numbers, as Neil had said, that we could have expected, but any school that closes is, of course, a tragedy for the families in that community. The last thing is just distribution of school closures. We did find something a little bit different from the Cato Institute findings. We actually had the largest numbers were, yes, in the Northeast. You can see the region shaded here. But really, our largest was in California, which is really interesting because percentage-wise of closures, because, of course, we all know California, even until recently, we had schools that were not permitted to open physically. So that really, I think, caused an extra hit to our schools that were in that state. I just want to end with what Donna also had highlighted, kind of those intangibles. One of the things that we saw over and over again was the value of community. And we have lots of data on this, but just to put some things up real quickly, these are just some of the great qualitative data we got. Really the care and concern that our teachers, our faculty, our staff, our leaders had for their community to continue to engage families, engage students, whether they were on campus or not. And that really has been a hallmark, I think, and a value add, or really rather articulating the value proposition for our schools, is to be able to continue that community engagement throughout this pandemic. Looking forward to next year, you know, certainly anticipating that we will continue to have challenges, but our schools have risen to the challenges thus far and are serving their communities really well.
Well, thank you all. So we've got a lot of questions and comments coming in. I'm going to get to those in just a minute. I just wanted to, I'm not sure that people have the context for overall private schooling. There are about 32,500 private schools in the country. About 14,000 of those have 50 or fewer students. My biggest worry with our tracker is there may be a lot of those schools that have gone out of business we just don't know about because they are too small to put out sort of a press release, and if they do, to get media to report it. So that's, I think, one of the reasons that certainly we have lower numbers than groups who are in contact with these schools. I'd also say that we've also tracked, I think, 29 non-COVID closures in the year, is 27 in the year, the first year of closure. So there are numbers in addition to those that had a specific COVID connection. I should also note that we have links to the surveys that Lynn showed, and also you can go to the NCEA website. I should have held this up, and you can get their annual sort of compendium on school numbers and enrollment and things like that. You go to their website, you can get that. And then we have a couple of questions. There's one from Vernon, and then we have one from Henry, and they both ask about homeschooling. And I thought that this was an interesting question because we've seen a lot of data, including, I think it was from the Census Bureau, that suggested, well, homeschooling may have gone from basically 3% of school-age kids a couple of years ago or 3 years ago to about 5% or so, I think a year or so ago, up to maybe 11% of students now. I think that the 11% may be a little high because the definition of homeschooling, at least as I read it, doesn't make it totally clear whether you are receiving your education from a school but at home online, or whether it's true homeschooling in that you as a family are running the schooling, you're controlling the schooling. But I'd be curious to know if any of you have a numbers or a sense for how many students you may have lost to actual homeschooling as opposed to students who are receiving instruction from schools at home.
I'm happy to take that. I don't think we lost many. In fact, although It Choice did a really interesting study to show that a lot of parents were testing out different models during this time. So, you know, some of them tried homeschooling, many of them were interested in pods, but our experience was that most families were, particularly if they were trying to work themselves, were looking for more structured settings. So even though, you know, there may be some, just a very minute number, at least in our membership, that's going to continue to do so. And those numbers are really hard to actually get. I know the Department of Education has tried to track numbers on homeschooling, and because people are often putting together various different programs, it can be hard to understand who is actually just homeschooling. You know, I think what we have found is the opposite, that some homeschooling families are now looking for a little more structure in our schools, and many of our schools, at looking at models in the future, are wondering if there are opportunities for them to give parents a little bit of both worlds. So, you know, the kind of structure that they may want for certain subjects or certain activities, plus, you know, whatever goals they had that drove homeschooling to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Just so we don't get in an answering rut where we're always going in the same order, I'll ask Lynn to answer Nath and then Dale. I'll try to keep changing it.
I would echo much of what Donna said. I think that many of our schools have tried intentionally well before COVID to establish positive relationships with homeschooling families and to offer some of those hybrid programs or courses or whatever the case may be. You know, my sense, and again, we don't have hard numbers, and Donna explained why those are hard to get, is that the gain that we're seeing from schools, from students and families that are leaving other types of educational options to come is far outpacing those that may be opting for a full-on homeschooling experience. And again, because our schools have generally tried to have that positive relationship with homeschooling families and to provide, you know, a la carte or different parts of their program, I would anticipate that will increase in the future and will become even a better partner to existing homeschooling families.
Great. Dale?
We haven't tracked that. It's difficult to know where people have gone once they left and haven't re-enrolled. I know reading different things in education publications, you know, there is this big gap of people missing, both public school and possibly, you know, since generally they don't track our schools that closely, and possibly some from our schools, but we haven't really heard that families were switching to homeschooling directly, even those who are doing, you know, the virtual or complete, you know, virtual want to be connected into a more formal structure. So I think it will be interesting to see what next year's school enrollment looks like and be able to possibly track better where those who are not re-enrolling are. But my slightly uneducated guess would be many of them have gone to public school rather than homeschool.
Thank you. So we have a question from, I don't have a name, it's just anonymous, but it's a pretty important question. Wanted to know, how have school closures this year compared to previous years? And it's hard to actually find that nationally, because at least all I was able to find was, I think it's every other year, and you kind of get net gain or loss. You don't know how many have gone down due to COVID. We don't have, you know, so good previous years for at least me to look at nationally. How have you all, how did closure numbers this year compare to previous years? And why don't we now, we'll go Lynn and then Dale and then Donna.
Yeah, again, as you just said, Neil, it's hard to look at that data, especially because we have you know, closures for any reason. So, you know, but my sense is looking at the data that we are certainly not seeing a tidal wave of any kind. You know, I think that they're fairly on par. When we look at ACSI membership, we're tracking. So in other words, if we were to look at the changes in membership year over year, we are about where we would expect ourselves to be this year. And had there been a deluge of schools that had closed or been financially challenged above and beyond what we normally experience year over year, certainly that number would have changed.
Great. Dale?
Well, we've been tracking school closures over the last couple of decades, and we have seen a steady high 1.89, 2.2 enrollment decline, as well as school closure decline. Actually, and that's primarily in the large urban districts where we've had very changing demographics, and school and parish closures were high number. So, and actually in the last decade, we've closed almost 16% of schools. So, but this year, like more than doubled what would be the annual closure rate for the last decade or two. So it's, you know, Catholic schools have declined significantly over the years. And biggest driving force for that has been the tuition increases and families' inability to or unwillingness to pay that.
Donna?
All right. We have seen very few schools close over the last few decades. What I would say, however, is that starting with the Great Recession, a number of schools started to feel softness in the market. And that was particularly in early childhood education, elementary schools, middle schools. And we found that families who used to really try to lock in independent school education as early as possible were now making choices. And many of them were making choices for high school and really saving their money for that. So, you know, so we have seen a lot of schools really hanging on since the Great Recession. I think the pandemic was another big hit for many schools, but it didn't end up being as big of a hit as they thought it would be. And so it's just a real mixed bag. But I think what we are concerned about is that there are aspects of this that may have a very long tail. And so if some of the families who have switched do not decide to stay in schools, or if they have saved enough money to maybe pay for 1 or 2 years of education, we're concerned that unless we really look at our business model and our prices moving forward, we may struggle even a little bit more in the years ahead, particularly, I think, the lower schools who have, you know, struggled after the Great Recession through the pandemic. And but ironically, I think, you know, as we look at what kids need, they may be just about the most important investment that a parent can make early on because of those social emotional skills that are going to be so important in a changing world.
All right, I'm going to ask a quick one on my own. I hope it's quick. Maybe I'll ask if you just give a 1 minute answer, because I want to get back to the questions and comments from the audience. But this has all made me think about, we're talking about CARES Act and things like that. There's sort of two things that I see going on. One, as I've analyzed the federal funding in all sorts of programs, CARES, CRRSA, ARPA, and upcoming, a lot of that money seems, or disproportionately, and I think Dale talked about this, disproportionately it seems geared toward public schools. So on one side, are you concerned that it'll be really hard to keep up with all the, you know, competing with public schools with what looks like they're going to get a whole lot of resources you may not have access to? On the flip side, we've seen this sort of profusion of school choice programs, new programs or expansion of the states. How do you see that all working out for your schools? You think it kinds of they cancel out, or will the headwinds become even greater because we may be looking at a lot of federal money that could possibly dwarf the school choice we're looking at? And maybe if you just want to raise your hand and answer, I won't even require everybody to answer it. I can't require it, really. I'm not the boss here. But all right, we'll start with Lynn.
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly we have a legal legislative department that's engaged in advocacy on behalf of Christian education, partners with a number of different organizations to advocate on behalf of private schools, faith-based or not. And certainly that is a concern. And that is something that we're working very hard to try and ensure that the private school voice and the faith-based sector, in addition, is at the table for those federal funds. So that is a concern. I think we are definitely encouraged by the it seems like the burgeoning movement towards school choice legislation in a number of states. So that is encouraging for us, and certainly continue to work at the state level with our schools and our networks to support that. One thing that I would mention, Neil, that we haven't talked about is that our schools, while we are trying to be at the table on behalf of our schools for federal and state money, we're also getting all kinds of data that our schools are themselves working hard to become sustainable. So we've seen an uptick in the number of mergers, for example, an uptick in the number of schools looking at third source incomes, and also looking to perhaps move the programs and things that they developed during this time of COVID to actually move them into another revenue stream or a way of serving families. So I think that the federal and the state funding is key, and we'll continue to show up for that. But in addition to that, our schools are reporting that they are really working to be innovative, to be sustainable for the future.
All right, Don or Dale, do you want Dale? Yeah, go ahead.
It is a concern for us on a number of levels. First and foremost, I mean, it's a justice issue. These funds that are being distributed through the various federal aid programs are taxpayer money, and all of our kids' parents are taxpayers, and they deserve a fair share of the funding resources. You know, there's this myth out there that all our schools are very wealthy. You know, we have high endowments, we have lots of expendable income. And that's really not true for almost all of our schools, that the expendable income in schools is very small, that we try to keep the tuition as low as possible to make it affordable and accessible for families. And so we don't have all this backup money that can, you know, help us to compete with public schools. We don't like to say we're competing with public schools. We are another alternative in a variety of options that families can choose. But we think making an artificial playing field, barriers have created a different playing field, are not fair to any family. And so, you know, we are continuing working with the other two groups that are here, the Christian Schools International and the independent schools, you know, working in concert with congressional leadership and the Department of Ed to get our kids to be considered fairly. And the other thing that I think is important, you know, that the mission of the school is what attracts families, and families will make great sacrifices to attend the school because they believe in the mission of the school, the community of the school, and they're not necessarily looking for the shiniest toys and, you know, the most advanced technology, that they want what we have to offer. And what we're asking for is a level playing field on which to be able to offer what we have. So, yeah, it's problematic, but I think we're able to keep our priorities straight. Mm-hmm. And we're not willing to sacrifice who we are for, you know, additional resources if it comes to that.
All right. Donna, do you want to say something on this?
Sure. I don't have much to add. I think my colleagues have expressed it well. The only thing I would want to say is, moving forward as a society, I hope we step back and say, what do we have to do to invest in all children, to really optimize the talent so that every child has an opportunity to succeed? And, you know, I hope we can switch some of the dialogue from a public versus private to really how do we have a school system that really serves every child, because it's really opportunity more than anything else that ensures that a society thrives.
Great. All right. We have time, I think, for one more question, although I'm going to throw two in, and if you want to address them both, that's fine. It's kind of sneaky and it's dirty, but I'm going to do it anyway. But Mark asks, why were teachers willing to return to the classroom at your schools when those who work in public or charter schools were unwilling to do so? I don't know that we can speak for people in other schools, but maybe you could say real fast why you think you were able to get your teachers to return. And then we had somebody, they don't have a name, but they wanted to know in particular whether the Catholic and Christian schools, COVID caused you in any way to sort of change the emphasis on your religious mission, but same would apply to independent schools. Did COVID cause you to change anything about your mission, maybe to bring in new students or to help new students who had come because of COVID feel more comfortable? And I will go, now we'll go back in our original order. We'll go to Donna, and then Dale, and then Lynn, and then we'll have to draw it to a close.
You know, I think, I don't know that anything changed us to change our mission. I mean, I think if anything, COVID has really focused our schools to go back to their why. to say what really matters more than anything else. And so I think that there's a lot of that. As to the teachers, I would say that why they went back to school is that our schools prioritize safety over everything else, and really worked with the teachers. So, you know, for the most part, these weren't hierarchical decisions. They were community decisions to put the students' needs first and to ensure that the school made deep investments into safety and to continually test that safety. And so, you know, we have not had many outbreaks at our school, but I think, you know, the combination of the community working together and these deep and across the board investments in safety have brought the teachers back.
Great, Dale.
Yes, I very similar sentiments. Our mission has not been compromised. I think because of the communal nature of our schools, the faith community and the community of believers together and welcoming hospitality of our schools, the kids come first. And so while, you know, schools and dioceses invested millions of dollars in safe environments, the teachers were also concerned about their students. And knowing that the environment was safe, they wanted to come back as well, that children needed them as well as their, you know, family and their home environment. And so we did not have great resistance for teachers coming back. Thank you, teachers.
All right, bring us home, Lynn.
Yeah, very similar. You know, I think that the safety investments, being able to work with teachers who were reluctant, being able to offer hybrid options, really be the flexibility, I think, of being in the private school sector, really worked well for our schools and enabled, you know, all teachers love their students, regardless of sector. All teachers want to be with their students, regardless of sector. I think there are just some real structural differences that enable private schools and our schools, our Christian schools, to be able to move very nimbly to be able to do that. And I would just echo what my colleague said. You know, this is an active conversation. We've collected data on this, and what we found is that the missions of our schools are not changing. What is changing is how it looks like we accomplished that mission, both in the COVID context, in the more hybrid context, in all the different challenges that we have in society. So the mission hasn't changed, but what does change and what does need to flex are our methods to actually reach and change those methods to reach that mission. The one thing I would say just about welcoming students onto the campus, I think that's been a real positive of our schools, is that there is that community feel and students are feeling welcome regardless of whatever different setting that they're coming from. If they're coming for the mission and they're mission appropriate students, whatever that might look like for that individual school, those schools are welcoming them with open arms and are making sure that they're able to fit in really well and be able to have an impact on the community as well.
All right, terrific. Well, I'm going to thank everybody, but first I promised the people who run the Cato Sphere Summit that I would mention the Sphere Summit, because there are probably a lot of educators watching this. We run something called the Sphere Summit. It'll be June 27th through July 1st and July 25th through July 29th. So two of these. It's about teaching. The tagline is teaching civic culture together. These are basically these terrific events where teachers, especially if you're in history or teach social studies or something like that, you'll hear from lots of different speakers showing how we can discuss kind of hot button political issues and public policy issues civilly, and also sort of introduce teachers to all these different perspectives. I'm pretty sure it's free. There's a little button there that says something about scholarships. But if you want to learn more, go to www.cato.org, /sphere, S-P-H-E-R-E, and you can learn more about that. since this was an education event, I promised I would do that. And now I want to thank, of course, the panelists for joining us today. I think these were terrific insights that give us a deeper look into how private schooling has done under COVID and it's what things look like for the future. And I want to thank all of you who have watched and sent questions and comments. And I hope you all have a good day.